free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see our past lineup of speakers, download some past shows, see the phone numbers if you're listening live to call in with questions if you'd like. We do ask that you wait to the end of the show. And you'll see this today, September 8th, 2008, our guest, two people from Razor Technologies, Mike Hayter, who is Razor's Director of Geothermal Development, and Richard Putnam, who's with Investor Relations. I had a long conversation with Richard about a week ago, creating our feature page about Razor Technologies. The company has developed a rapid deployment capability for low-heat geothermal energy. The geothermal pipes are in a closed loop tied to a heat exchanger that heats a refrigerant, which runs a turbine in a reverse refrigeration type system, generating electricity in a cost-effective manner, competing price-wise with coal or natural gas. And if they had enough companies getting involved, they could ramp up the U.S. Geothermal to the 10% of all electrical needs of the United States within 10 years, meeting that portion of Al Gore's goal to reach 100% renewable within 10 years. So they have a very exciting technology, and we're glad to have them on. Mike and Richard, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good afternoon. Good to be here. Thank you.
Good afternoon to you. First, we'd like to kind of get an overview of the technology and how it works. You know, how I mentioned briefly in the introduction, but maybe you can go into a little more detail about how that works.
Be happy to. This is Mike Hayter. The technology is referred to as binary generation technology. There are typically three types of current technologies used for power generation and geothermal. The first being a dry steam. There's limited dry steam resources available in the world. So the next technology is referred to as flash, where water that's typically above 350 degrees Fahrenheit is brought to the surface under pressure and then flashed at the surface into a steam to drive turbines. And then binary uses lower temperatures, typically in our case 250 degrees to low 300s, which is considered a low to moderate temperature geothermal resource. We bring up the hot water from the earth, run it through a closed loop system. It goes into a heat exchanger. At that point, heat is extracted and used to heat up a secondary fluid called a binary fluid, hence the name binary generation. It's a refrigerant, a non-polluting refrigerant that then flashes the steam at approximately 57, 58 degrees Fahrenheit, and it then the pressure and then of the steam drives a turbine to generate electricity. The hot water, the hot geothermal water, is then re-injected back into the resource to find its way back into that resource to be reheated and eventually recycled and pumped through the system again. So that, in a nutshell, is how we generate electricity.
There's also on the cooling tower end of the secondary fluid. Maybe you could talk about that for a second.
Sure. We have to condense the binary fluid. Once it's been flashed to steam, we then condense it with cooling water. That brings it back into a liquid form, and it cycles through again through that process. This is, in effect, very similar to an air conditioning process. If you look at how an air conditioner works, or a large commercial air conditioner, a centrifugal chiller, which would use electricity electricity comes in into the system, and you get cold out of the other system, we reverse this. And we bring heat into the system, and we get electricity out of the other end. And, in fact, our partner, which is United Technologies Power, is the parent company, United Technologies is the parent company of Carrier Corporation, and the pure cycle generation unit that we use is, in effect, a reverse-engineered centrifugal chiller. So the technology has been around for decades to do this, and together in working with UTC, we have been able to both use lower temperature resources, and we've designed these units in such a way that we can rapidly deploy them on resources that are lower temperature, enabling us to build small networked plants or plants that throughout the western U.S. and other places in the world.
I find the approach to be very ingenious using, because the steam or the heat coming from the water, from the geothermal heated water, it is not hot enough to use in the traditional flash or dry steam method. You're basically taking that heat, the low-grade heat, and you're heating the secondary fluid that does have a very low boiling point, which can then give you that same kind of the steam principle that turns your turbines, which gives you your ability to turn a generator to make electricity. And I'm curious, why has it taken so many years to get to this point? Is it just that somebody clever enough to put technology A with technology B has taken this long?
Well, the idea for binary generation has been around for some time. In the U.S., one of the first plants that was produced using a binary technology that was not UTC. They were successfully able to build a small generation plant, and there has been binary development over the past approximately 20-25 years that has gone on. What is different is that it hasn't been able to generate from temperatures that are as low grade as what we're using now with United Technologies, and it's always been a much longer lead time. These units were typically designed to fit the resource. So you have a longer lead time in defining the size of the resource and then custom designing and engineering the generation unit and specifically the turbine to fit that resource. So if you have a 50 megawatt resource or a 25 megawatt resource, you were ultimately designing your power plant from scratch on a custom engineering basis to fit that, which really added to both the cost and the time it took to develop the resource. The change that has happened is enabled us. We've taken a small generator approach. These units are approximately 250 to 280 kilowatts each, and we put them together in sort of a network, I think would be the best analogy, in which we don't need to define the resource to its ultimate size. We simply need to determine whether or not we have, for example, our approach is to go after 10 megawatt size plants as a minimum. So if we're comfortable that we have 10 megawatts of resource, then we can quickly take off the shelf generation units and develop the wells and in parallel develop the construction of the plant and have those online in a very rapid manner. So that's really what's changed. We've gone from a 3 to 5 year development period, and typically 5 years, to a development period of approximately a year to a year and a half.
Well, you've gone even faster than that in Beaver, Utah, here, Beaver County, just south of us. I should mention that here at PES Network, we're just about a 40-minute drive from Razor Technologies over in Provo, Utah, and The first plant you've installed is down in Beaver County, what's about a 3-hour drive from here.
That's correct.
And you started in May, and you're going to be doing a ribbon cutting next month. That's 5 months.
That was very rapid. Actually, we'll be about 1 year from spudding our first well to producing power on the grid. So you're right, that's been a very rapid development. And not only has it been a rapid development, we've discovered in the process that we have not enough just for 10 megawatts, but we've discovered what has been the largest geothermal discovery in the past 25 years and is estimated to be approximately 238 megawatts by Geothermix, one of the industry's premier third-party consultants on reservoir engineering and resource consulting.
You just announced last week that you had installed 50 of these generators firm, United Technologies Corporation. They arrived August 12th. You had them deployed September, what was it, 3rd?
That's, approximately that date, I believe.
Yeah, 3 weeks. You had delivery of the generators, and you plugged them into your the stands. You had the cement bases for them, and so that went really fast.
Yeah, the construction of these plants is really is very quick. We pour the pads, we set the units, and then we start connecting the wires and bringing in the pipe to connect all of that. What we need to do is from there is just complete wells and then turn them off or turn them on, excuse me, and we're able to generate power. But I think this has gone very well for us. We don't predict sub-1 year projects when they come along. We're very excited about them, and this one's gone very well for us. But typically we would expect at least a year to a year and a half on development.
Would you say that the drilling of the holes down into the resource is probably the most challenging part and expensive part of the process?
Drilling is always where you find the most risk. It's in the past what has made geothermal a more difficult resource to develop. It's easy to see the wind and to test the wind. It's easy to understand where the solar is and what the best place is for those. But the reason geothermal, even with those risks, is such a good investment is because it provides a 24/7 constant base load, we call it in the industry, a base load power supply, one that's constantly available and typically available more than 92% of the time. But drilling is an area of risk. Again, we're able to take care of that risk because we don't have to define the entire resource. We can define it up to a point. And then we know we've got the 10 megawatts of resource, for example, and whether or not there's 20, 50, or 200, we're satisfied. We meet our minimum satisfaction and minimum requirements for investing in that plant development. So we do reduce the risk considerably. And we're learning a lot about every time you drill a new hole, you learn a little bit more about geothermal and the resources. And so we're gathering a tremendous amount of useful information for future projects.
Let's talk about the Beaver facility for a second. You call it thermo from the, I guess they have a thermo.
It's a legacy name, the thermo known geothermal resource area. In fact, the plant will be named once the ribbon cutting happens after Senator Hatch. That was announced at the groundbreaking in recognition of his support for Razor Technologies and for renewables and geothermal in general.
Okay, so it'll be called the Hatch facility, not thermo?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So down there at that facility, you started out knowing you had 10 megawatts. You drilled. Meanwhile, while you had this infrastructure development underway, you discovered that you had the potential for 230 megawatts, and you leased additional land. You had, 25,000 acres? Now you have 30,000 acres additional. To be able to access that infrastructure-wise and control room-wise, how are you going to add on those additional megawatts?
Well, this is what I think is so unique about what Razor Technologies is doing. This is our not only are we rapid deployment, but we have a modular deployment. We've set up a methodology whereby we can now we've continued drilling. We actually have enough data to and have already planned for the next modular deployments of the site. In this case, what we simply do is add additional pads and bring in more equipment. We do suspect outside of that we may have some temperatures that would be sufficient for flash development, and that would be more traditional development, and we expect to pursue that as well. But our modular technology, because these units are built off-site, they're skid-mounted and shipped, ready to plug in, it's not too difficult then to go from a 10-megawatt plant to, say, a 20, 30, or 50-megawatt operation in the future. I should point out that each time we extend those, then we negotiate, we either add that to an existing PPA or renegotiate new PPAs as well. So although it might be one resource, we might have we might be selling that power to different companies.
To compare this to, say, the computer, you know, I buy a computer, and let's say I've got 320, I'm just throwing numbers out, I'm not sure if they have 320 megabyte memory chips. Then I decide later that I want to upgrade. I just add it. They have slots for additional memory, and I just either swap out or actually add additional modules. It's kind of what you're doing here, where you have a modular design, just plug in additional units as needed.
Yeah, in fact, I would take your analogy and I would take it to the next step. Rather than just one computer, I would compare this to, say, a mainframe computing versus our current networked server computing or cloud computing. If you have a data center and you have one massive machine that has to be designed and maintained to for certain applications, you have a similar environment to a mainframe environment. But what we're analogous to is a networked server environment. If we find that there's more need or more resource, then we simply add more servers, so to speak. We add additional units and capacity to fit both the resource size, and we know there's a demand. There's more demand coming out of California than I think all of the current projects could meet, but let alone some of the other states like Arizona, the other western states, New Mexico, Utah's joined that, and Oregon, that also have mandated minimums of renewable energy. There's plenty of demand. Now we can simply add and grow, on this server analogy, plants that are not only just in those specific, say, a thermal area, but also into other areas very quickly for a distributed generation system.
And unlike solar and wind technologies, where the mandate is basically forcing the power companies and the governments to take on technologies, whether or not they're saving money or cost effective. In your case, the geothermal is actually coming in at the same price point, if not maybe a little lower than what they have been paying for the coal or natural gas powered plants.
Well, we see the cost of all energy. Unfortunately, as consumers, we all see that cost going up. And at this point, it's inevitable. Even the cost of coal is increasing. It will increase more, in fact, as other types of taxes and as we consider the cost of transportation to get coal there and some of the additional costs associated with the pollution that comes from coal. So the cost of even traditional methods of generation of fuels is going up. So what we're seeing in the industry is an increasing cost for all types of energy. Although some of the renewables, as they get deployed, are starting to come down, so you're seeing a comparable cost there. Again, the advantage we have, we believe that wind and solar are very necessary components of meeting our renewable energy needs. But they've, what's happened is they've taken the limelight, and often, as you'll see various politicians talk about renewable energy, they mention only wind and solar, and there's a missing piece there, and that is that they're intermittent resources. If you build a 100 megawatt wind farm, you have to build infrastructure, transmission, et cetera, to support the 100 megawatts at peak, but you're only going to see it operating at peak, maybe 30% of the time, and so you have to overbuild the resource and the plant on a wind farm to accommodate for the peak. And in fact, in some situations, in talking with utilities, studies have been done where the peak load requirement and the peak load generation are only coinciding about 4 or 5% of the time. So you're building a lot of infrastructure with wind. And not being able to see the benefit of it all the time. It's 20 to 30% at best. Geothermal does give you that 92-plus percent reliability or that baseload power generation that's needed to offset these other intermittent supplies. So it ends up fitting very well into what wind and solar are doing as a baseload balancing supply.
Why are you not calling geothermal 100%? Where is the 8% the unreliability coming from?
Well, there's always, you have to factor in, this is traditional uptime. We believe we'll see uptimes that are much closer to 100%, but you always have to factor in for some sorts of unforeseen maintenance issues and that sort of thing. The advantage we have with our approach is that we can remove, on a 50-megawatt plant, for example, or a 10-megawatt plant at Thermo, we have two units that are purely backup units. We can also very quickly remove units from generation, and we have enough net generation to meet our needs and our commitments to the grid and to the utility, and still pull units offline for standard maintenance and even emergency maintenance. So we have a redundant system that can supply that. But 92% is an industry number. We believe our percentage is going to be higher, probably closer to 95 to 96%. And there's always that little. But we may find out in 10 years of monitoring these that we're closer to that 100% that you've mentioned. But,
I just thought of another analogy, maybe a little bit crude, but when you go to a thrill park such as Disneyland, you've got these rides, and they've got, you'll see off to the side the cars that are not being used, and there are two reasons for that. Number one, maybe they're in a lower time of day and they're not having as many riders. They'll pull some offline. Also, possibly some of those need to be serviced. Some of them are just backup. And then as one maybe goes bad, they can just pull it off and put a better one on. That's if I understand right, that's kind of the model that you're using here, where you keep a constant number of things in operation. You have some backups ready to go, and you can pull some offline if you need to, fire up another one that's been sitting unused, another generator system, and basically keep your very close to 100% base load capability going at all times.
We do believe that we'll be able to keep a close to a near 100% availability, and I think the analogy is mostly correct. Yeah.
So one of the I would consider maybe a downside to geothermal is that it is 100% same load all the time, whereas the usage by the customers goes up in peaks and valleys. In the evening, in the morning, you've got these peaks, and then at night you're using hardly anything. But meanwhile, the geothermal plant is just cranking away 100%. And so obviously there needs to be other energy sources that can be ramped up, ramped down, so that not just throwing all the you're not producing peak load capability at all times, but you can back off the system for the end users.
Well, I think we have a couple of answers or responses to that, and I would actually say that it's not a disadvantage. It actually turns out to be an advantage. There's enough need for balancing intermittent supplies right now that that geothermal fits into the equation. No matter what time of the day or time of generation peak or not you're talking about, there's still a tremendous need to have this baseload power as part of the grid, especially with all of the wind and solar that's coming online over the next several years. So I think that we'll balance that out very well. The other point I would make, and it's not really the topic of the conversation, but it's part of our business strategy, is that we recognize that there's a tremendous opportunity to shift some of the demand into the nighttime. And our other business unit is involved in advanced motor tech, electric motor technology, and controllers, and we have strategic agreements in place to develop plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, PHEVs. We are currently working with the German auto, it's a global auto integrator, very well known in the industry, called FEV, and we're partnered with one of the largest auto manufacturers in the world. We can't name them yet, but together we're building a full-size, light truck and SUV prototypes that are plug-in hybrid vehicles. And these we hope to see as the years roll on here in both the near and the midterm, plug-in hybrids will start to play a bigger role and you'll start to see more energy demand through the evening as customers will need to charge these vehicles. So we call it our well-to-wheel strategy. We're using the wells to produce electricity from the Earth's own heat, and then the wheels, the motors, the plug-in hybrids that will consume that heat and ultimately help us to break the dependency that we have on carbon fuels, both for our transportation and for our electricity needs.
So at night, which has traditionally been the lowest usage time, that usage is going to increase as people are plugging in their electric vehicles at night to recharge them for use the next day. And the geothermal constant load, the base load capability, enables that to be covered at night as well.
That's our proposition, and that's what we think is going to happen. We're actually very excited about how those two strategies fit together.
I'd like to back up to how this thing works for a minute and talk about the drilling end of things and how this closed loop looks on the water side of pulling. You're actually pumping water out of the ground and then dropping it back in once it's gone through the heat exchanger?
That's correct.
So basically there are underground reservoirs or pockets of water, so to speak, that you drill down far enough to get, and those are 200 to 300 degrees. You pump those up with a pump, and if I remember right from what Richard was telling me the other day, the total, your 10 megawatt is net, and you're actually producing 14 megawatts, four of which is required to run your pumps to pump the water out to run through your system.
That's right. We have the 10 to 10 and a half is a net output. Because we are pumping water both up from the ground and through the system, we do have what's called a parasitic load. We have some of the electricity that we're producing will run the plant itself. So there's an overall net output to the grid of 10 to 10 and a half megawatts, but some consumption of the power plant to run things. I should point out, though, that the amount of power required for the plant to run, for the pumps to run, will differ depending on the resource. You manage a resource to a certain degree by creating, by manipulating the pressure that's in the wells. Hot water wants to rise, and so you manipulate that. You get a system working to the point, ideally, where the hot water rising is actually creating a dynamic system that would be pulling down the cooled geothermal water. But because it's always something that's it's dynamic, you have to still use the pumps to try to find that equilibrium between the hot water rising and the cold water going down into the system. And these are very typically very large systems, and so you do have to account for some amount of energy use for the pumps to move the water through the system and pump it back and re-inject it into the earth.
One of your generators, you say, is 250 to 280 kilowatts. And I'm curious, how many holes does that account for that are going down into the ground, pulling up water, running through a heat exchanger?
On a typical 10-megawatt net site, you'll see about four, maybe five wells for production.
Okay.
And that would be accompanied by approximately three injection wells.
So four to five to pull out, three to drop back in?
Right.
When my graphic artist was working up a drawing for our site on this, he had the loops closed at both into the ground and up above, and I had him change those so it shows the pipes in the bottom are actually open. You're sucking up stuff from one end and then dropping it into another area, into the same reservoir, so to speak, kind of like a water tank.
It's very similar to that. And when you engineer the system, we take into account that we don't want to reinject the cooled water. We don't want to reinject it too close to where we're pulling out the hot water. So we spread those out some distance, but we also take into account the heat flow and the direction of water flow that we pick up from our study, and do it in a way that we can get that cooled water into the resource to get reheated. Now that can happen in the terms of years. It could take years. It could take months. It just depends on the dynamics of each resource. But the idea is to maintain a resource in which you're extracting water and then replacing it to maintain pressure and maintain water, which is, you don't want to be depleting the water or the heat in the resource. And this is a way to manage that effectively.
Let's talk for a minute about the impact in the local existing farmland resources that exist above the ground. If I understand right, you basically, you're leasing, you're not buying the property because you don't need all the, you don't need what's above, you need what's below. And so while you might have 30,000 acres, 25,000 acres together, so what's that, 55,000 acres, you only need 5 acres for your plant. Everything else is just holes being drilled into the ground. You can still run sheep or corn or whatever it was before. So the farmers like you coming in there because they're getting added revenue by leasing the land to you.
That's true. Our footprint is relatively small compared to the output, for example, to other renewables, especially solar and wind. We still leave, even though we lease a large area, we do that because we want to have enough surface access that we can explore and find the resource and develop the resource. Ultimately, once you have a wellhead in, it takes very little, it's very little space that's required to maintain the wellhead, and the power plant itself is small. Ultimately, we end up having about consuming maybe about 20 acres for a 10 megawatt plant. It is relatively small, and it does allow for multiple uses of the surface. So a lot of farmers continue to run their cattle, they'll still continue to grow hay or whatever other agricultural products they have.
How many holes do you have to drill? And I'm sure this depends on where you're located, what your resources is like, but I imagine not every one of your holes that you drill are productive.
Well, in this case, every hole that we drilled was productive in Thermo case.
Uh-huh.
We did some studies. We partnered with EGI and with our internal experts, and we were able to come up with what we felt was enough mitigated risk to go ahead and drill production holes. We did drill one hole that was meant to be production, and I believe will end up being an injection well, but we were able to still have a use for that well and not lose the investment. Now, we understand that that's probably not a 100% scenario. We're not going to see that every time, but we have developed, I think, some good experience, and we'll be very good at drilling productive holes. And in cases where the production hole isn't quite what we thought it would be, it may still service as an injection hole.
How far are you having to drill down to get to what you need?
Well, in the case of Thermo, that's not information we've released. It is private information, but I would say that generally speaking, you'll see us drilling between 1,500 feet and about 5 or 6,000 feet, depending on the resource and the area that we're developing.
Uh-huh. I would imagine that would impact price quite a bit, is how far you have to go down.
Well, it certainly helps to drill a shallower well. Yeah, the economics are better on that. But in this case, for a 10-megawatt plant, a 5,000-foot hole is well within the economics of what we're doing.
Uh-huh. Another thing in talking about the above-ground resources that you are using in one of these scenarios, you do need water, and you're getting that from a local creek or something that you're using to help cool the secondary fluid, which is actually quite tepid compared to what is required to boil water. So it might be heating up the water a little bit, but not much, while it's still serving so basically you're not gobbling up a lot of local resources water-wise compared to, say, if you were a nuclear plant where you're pulling it off in steam and it's going up into the air.
Well, we do have some consumptive use of water because we use evaporative water coolers for these plants. And the amount of water that would be consumed will vary depending on wet bulb temperatures. So depending on where you are in altitude and temperatures and seasonal fluctuations of temperatures. So in summer, we'll experience a greater need for the condensing and some consumptive use. But we do try to be as effective and as efficient as we can in the cooling water and condensing water use by treating the water, by being able to run it multiple times through a cycle through the cooling towers. So we're very cognizant of our consumption of water. But it does require some cooling water use, and in the future we hope to develop additional capabilities around air cooling.
What kind of volumes are we talking about? Say your 10 megawatt plant in the middle of summer where you've got a lot of environmental heat you have to work against.
That'll vary greatly depending on whether we're talking about a project in Oregon where we're working on or thermo. But I can't answer your questions and say acre feet a year. I know that we pump a large. We're recirculating a lot of this water, so this isn't actually the consumptive use, but we may be pumping some in the area of about through the system about 1,000 gallons a minute of condensing water, and how much of that actually ends up being consumed, the evaporative content is what we lose, and then in some cases we actually reinject some of the cooling water as well back in. As long as we can ensure that it's not going to be changed in chemical or quality, then we're able to reinject some of that water back into aquifers as when that makes sense. For example, our New Mexico project will reinject probably 400 gallons per minute of water back into the earth. So we try to reduce the consumption as much as we can.
The 400 gallons per minute, this is the above ground water?
No, yeah, that's the condensing water. We're actually re-injecting some of the condensing water, or will be. We're still in the construction phase of that, but the plan will be to treat some of that water. As it goes through the cycle, it gets more and more salt content as you have some evaporative loss of the condensing water, and so what we do is we'll treat that water to extract or to be able to re-inject a water that's of a quality that won't damage the existing aquifers or change the chemical or parts per million on the TDS of those specific aquifers. So we're doing a combination of things to try to keep the water quality good, use it a little as necessary, and even be able to re-inject some of that water.
In terms of permitting and licenses and whatnot, how many loopholes are there to jump through in geothermal energy?
Well, there's very few loopholes, but there are a lot of hoops to jump through. It does require, and it varies state by state, and it varies depending on what type of resource you're looking at. If you're looking at a federal geothermal lease, or if you have a private or state lease, so depending on who owns the resource, then that changes the types and number of permits that are required. But typically speaking, you have to have surface permits for construction permits, for example. There's some environmental permits that are required. We go through a very rigorous process of understanding what our environmental impact is going to be and complying with existing regulations on that. And then there are permits for drilling and permits for water use and permits for any discharge, of which there's none. In our case, there's zero emissions, but we still go through the process of getting all appropriate permits that are required either by the state or the federal government or both, depending on where we're operating.
One of the things that you don't have to worry about with the binary system, if I understand right, is that because it's a closed-loop system of water coming out of the earth and going back in, you're not introducing some of the sulfur that might be coming into the air in these steam scenarios where where you've got the underground water coming up and being vented as steam, and some of that contains pollutants such as the sulfur and whatnot.
Well, yeah, flash technology does introduce potentially some, depending on, and this again, it gets all back to the quality of the resource. If you have a very, if some geothermal resources have a lot of various chemicals in them, the various metals and gases that are in the system, that are naturally found in the system, and others are quite clean, so it varies. But binary is a lower emitting technology than flash. There's as close to zero emissions as you can get.
Now, if I understand right, you have the, you know, we've mentioned a couple of plants, New Mexico, actually three, Oregon and Utah. Don't you have eight under construction right now?
We have eight projects that we've announced that are under development, under various phases of development and construction. Yeah. We actually have other projects, but those are what we've announced.
Uh-huh.
And there was recently another project announced, got out from underneath us, but announced in Indonesia.
Yeah, I saw that last week. That's a huge project over there where they're basically replacing a lot of infrastructure over in Indonesia. It's a very mineral and resource-rich area with a lot of oil, and they're actually moving to renewables aggressively. And so apparently you got... was that with Cates that you were involved?
We're actually involved directly with Indonesia Power, which is a state-owned... It is the subsidiary of PLN. PLN is the state-owned energy company, and IP, Indonesia Power, is the electrical generation subsidiary of that, and we have a partnership with them that we entered into to jointly win and develop a concession that is estimated to be between 200 and 300 megawatts, and will be a combination of binary and flash development.
Mm-hmm. Are you pursuing international contracts aggressively, or just taking them as they come?
We're keeping our eyes open for opportunities.
Now, talking about the rollout speed, when I was talking to Richard, and I asked the question, you know, the MIT study said that all of the U.S. geothermal resources could account for about 10% of supplying 10% of the U.S. energy needs, and I think they said by 2021 or something like that. And then Al Gore comes along and he says, and, you know, he challenged U.S. to go 100% renewable within 10 years. And I asked the question just philosophically, could Razor's technology ramp up the U.S. geothermal capability to its full capacity of 10% within 10 years? And
well,
he said,
I think there's a couple of ways to approach that question. I think Razor will play a key role in moving us towards being able to take advantage of all the geothermal that we can. Binary is just one area of geothermal development. It's one that has not been developed to its fullest, and that's where we think right now what we have is, I would call it very much a strategic bridging technology where we can go from lower temperatures into other technologies. There's quite a bit of research going on around what's called EGS, the Enhanced or Engineered Geothermal Systems, which is, if I may divert for just a moment, is a technology. It used to be called hot, dry rock. You can always drill and find heat, but the challenge is finding the heat where you have the water as a medium to bring the heat up. And so there's quite a bit of research being done around how to create man-made geothermal reservoirs. It's a very complicated engineering process and has not yet been perfected. But there's significant money flowing that direction to do that. It's not commercially viable right now, despite Google's involved and other companies have been some other high profile companies and organizations have been involved in developing that. So there's been some studies done, and we certainly need to be looking towards the future and developing those technologies. But this advanced binary technology will bridge that gap for the next several years. For the next 10 years, we'll be able to, our plan is to introduce for the first 3 years, 100 megawatts of new projects per year, and then 100 growing to 150 megawatts per year. So in the next 10 years, we see ourselves developing a little more than 1,000 megawatts of power, and that's our promise to the market and to our investors. Now we hope that we can realize that goal, and I think I'm not saying we'll exceed it, but we certainly will look for opportunities to expand our role and our position in being a critical part of what this nation needs in developing these new resources. 10 years is a very aggressive time frame to be 100% renewable.
It is.
But we'll do our best in trying to meet that.
So 1,000 megawatts within 10 years is 1% of the potential, because there's 100,000 megawatts possible of geothermal. And so Richard's comment was, well, it's possible but not plausible.
I think, just to clarify that, Sterling, not plausible for Razor to do all that. Obviously, if there's a lot more capital employed towards this and a number of other companies that are in there helping us, then that certainly could happen. But I think you're right. That would be an extreme amount of capital employed, and likely not to see happen in the next 10 years, but we're standing there ready for it.
Do you think, with the argument that the energy is at the same price point, if not possibly lower, as the fossil fuel technologies continue to rise in price, that there's not just going to be a political expedient to roll out geothermal, but there will be an economic incentive as well?
I think you're right. I think there is an economic incentive. I think we will see, this is my prediction in the market, and I think it's holding out in terms of what we're saying. We're going to see a rise in costs across the board for energy production, energy generation, and before we see a decrease. So we're going to go through a time of seeing increasing energy prices, and because there's such a need for capital to be deployed in developing these, we're going to have to really, I think there's going to have to be some patience in the market as consumers and as political leaders and in industry to deal with that inevitable rise in costs that's happening right now, before we see that come down. And it's going to take some years and some real dedication to this plan that we're all on. There's differing opinions about what the goal should be and how fast it should happen, but I think the answer to the question is we'll see rising costs before we see lowering costs. But in the long run, because, for example, geothermal has no cost of fuel, we do have a very expensive capital cost up front, but there's no fuel cost over the long run that I think we can see geothermal playing an important role in helping to buffer the increases and to maybe someday in the future even help decrease some of those costs.
Aren't you estimating a return on investment of about 18 months?
What do you mean by a return on investment?
Meaning that there's a high capital cost, but since you don't have the fuel cost and the operation costs are low, then the time to recoup the capital costs, with solar, for example, has been 20, 30 years, if at all, that you can recoup your costs compared to what you would have otherwise with local utility power. But with geothermal, since you don't have the cost, the maintenance costs and the operational costs are very low, that enables you to recoup that cost a lot faster. So when I say return on investment, I mean earning back through sales of electricity the amount of money to raise the project in the first place.
I think, Sterling, we're earning a good return, but I don't think we're earning that great of a return. That would probably be a lot more than what power companies and municipalities are willing to pay. It is true that geothermal does, on an operating basis, has very low costs, since there is no cost of fuel. The heat provides the fuel for the generation of power. However, these plants still are somewhat costly to build. And as Mike pointed out, the pricing of these are starting to come down. The technology is starting to get better, and you'll see that we'll be able to roll these out in a much cheaper format than we are currently in this first few. But I think the time to recoup that investment is probably a little longer than 18 months.
Uh-huh. Do you have a number that you give out for the return on investment time?
We have not to date.
Uh-huh. Well, we've got about a couple minutes left on the show. Are there any areas that we've not addressed that you would like to bring up?
Nothing occurs to me. I just would like to point out that we very much appreciate the opportunity to share Razor's story and to talk about our technology. I think I would just reiterate that that we are doing something in the geothermal and renewable energy that's never been done before, and we've already shown that we can accomplish that with our first plant, Thermo, and we will repeat that with our next plants and continue to get better at executing our plan as we have presented it to the market, and we're very excited to be a part of this industry, and thank you for the opportunity.
You're certainly welcome. Something occurs to me that we've not given enough emphasis to, and that is that the company you're employing to build your units, the United Technologies Corporation, they are well experienced in a long-term company in the air conditioning business, and about 95% of the components required for your system are used in their existing air conditioning units on these, big buildings. And so it's really no drama for them to crank out as many of those as you need in a mass production type of scenario. So that is not going to be the logjam in your situation.
No, I think I think you're right. United Technologies is a fantastic partner. They have developed, they've re-engineered and redeployed technology that's used in their carrier air conditioning operations, commercial operations, to this industry and to our application. And so I think that speaks volumes of what we can accomplish together. And I think really the constraint is one of expertise in geothermal industry. There was a big push in the 70s and 80s, and it kind of died for a while, and now attracting good talent to this industry is critical for us to grow, and capital becomes an issue, especially in the current situation we're in, where capital is constrained in our current markets, and it'll be important to see that constraint loosened up, the cost of capital decrease, as Wall Street and the industry sees how geothermal is developed, and they get better acquainted with geothermal versus wind and solar, and understanding the benefits of it, I think we'll see that those become less of a hindrance to the overall development of this industry and of this tremendous resource we have.
Right. Quickly, your website address?
It is www.razortech, spelled RASERTECH.com.
And you are a publicly traded company. Your stock exchange number is?
RZ, and we are in America. We're traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
Thank you, Mark Hader and Richard Putnam, for joining us from Razor Technologies. You've been listening to Free Energy Now.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.